We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
It is now 8:09 here at WCCO. Welcome back. You are listening to Steel Talk, and I'm your host, Gerilyn Steele, and I absolutely love being here with you on a Sunday night. There's so much to talk about, and of course, you know that the U.S. Congress is also involved in this mess that we have right now in our country. In fact, they have been conspicuously quiet. Conspicuously. That's hard to, you would think that would be the one thing they wouldn't want to be, but they are. Silent. Well, joining us tonight to give us some understanding of this lack of communication from Washington and so much more is David Schultz, political science professor at Hamline University, and we are thrilled to have him back on Steel Talk. And how are you, Professor?
I am doing great. It's been a while since we talked.
It has been a long while. I feel like Esme stole you from me. I'm only kidding, sir. I'm only kidding.
You may need to work that out with Esme.
Exactly. Let's begin by defining the job of Congress, because maybe we get here because there is some misunderstanding about what Congress is supposed to do.
Well, depends on how you want to define their job. Article 1 of the Constitution lays out the powers of Congress. They have a whole host of things that they can do in terms of legislating. But if I were to sort of summarize a lot of different things, members of Congress are supposed to represent us. They are, and represent could either mean they do what we tell them to do or they act in our best interests. They're supposed to, I think, at the same time, act on the best interests of the United States, to legislate for the common good. There's a lot of different ways of describing it. When I teach my classes, I sometimes say that elected representatives are supposed to be trustees for the people. They are there to act in our behalf and to do the public good.
Is it affected, what they are supposed to do, is it affected by the demographics and the changes in some of the areas?
Of course it is, yeah. And I think this is something that we oftentimes forget about, is that we like to think of Congress as being like our national legislature. But remember, Congress is not elected across the United States in terms of one body. Like, we don't get to vote for all 435 people in the House, all 100 senators. They all represent separate districts. And what Congress really is a very sort of localized body that, in many ways, when, let's say, I am up in the 8th district, up around, let's say, Duluth, mm-hmm. The person who I elect to Congress there, I hope on one level, represents the interests of the people in the 8th district. Somebody who we elect from Minneapolis, we hope represents the interests of people from Minneapolis. And you send all those people off to Congress and say to them, we would like you to represent Minneapolis or Duluth or St. Paul or Worthington or Thief River Falls. Each of those districts has different people, different demographics, different interests, and those representatives go off and they fight for their constituents. And guess what? That produces a situation where not everybody agrees as to what they want, and 435 House members, 100 senators, are all pushing for what they may think is in the best interest of their people, but not necessarily in the best interest of the United States.
Exactly, and that has been a real challenge for me. I've always thought that the Congress would legislate for the most Americans that they can, you know, the most of us. You'll never get all of us in it.
Right.
But if you could do your best to legislate for the most of us, then you have really done a great job, and we are far from that today.
That's absolutely correct, and we can measure this in lots of different ways. One way to measure it is to look at, for example, just the partisan split between the Democratic and Republican parties. And in several of my talks that I've given, I say, let's think back about 40 years ago to the mid-70s. If we were to look at, for example, the number of votes that occurred that were bipartisan, the two major parties agreed, versus straight party line votes, vast majority of the votes were bipartisan, and we saw the two parties working together. And we also saw a very high percentage of legislation, or a lot of legislation, being adopted. Take us to today, and the number of votes that are bipartisan is very, very little. There's very few in terms of that. Most of them are straight party line. And if we think that passing legislation is a good thing, and certainly not everybody does. Some people will say not doing anything is good.
Not doing anything is doing something.
Is doing something, that's right. We know that for the last couple of years, we've had the least productive Congress since, I think, the 1940s. As you sort of were opening up with your statement here, is Congress getting anything done? Not really. For the most part, they're really not accomplishing anything. And this is really especially surprising given the fact that the Congress is controlled by Republicans, both chambers. President is a Republican. One would think that they could get a lot done. They didn't. Remember many years ago, the first 2 years of the Obama administration, a Democratic president, House and Senate were also controlled by Democrats, and how much they actually got done was also nowhere near what people thought.
Yeah, but they did get done. The biggest thing that we've seen in this millennium, which is health care. I mean, that was
huge. They're right. They did get some things done. There's no question about it. And you're making a great point here, is that if I were looking at, let's say, 2009-2010, far more was accomplished then than now. But if I were to look at 2009-2010 and compare that to, let's say, 1978, hardly anything by comparison. So it's truly the case over the last 40 years, and this is the time frame that I like to use, that Congress is actually getting less and less done because of, I think, in part, the partisanship, the polarization, but also, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, the fact that it really is a body that is not centralized, but it's very decentralized, pulled in the House of Representatives case, 435 separate directions.
So I will say that, you know, you watch the Congress work right now, and they are rolling things back. They are doing some things. They're getting some things done that I would say the majority of Americans are totally against, and they're doing it very quietly, almost stealth-like. But,
right.
But here's where I want clarity, sir. Does the Constitution require Congress to work across the political lines? You said it yourself. When things were really getting done, it was bipartisan. But there's nothing really in our Constitution that spells that out, right?
You're right. You're correct. Nothing requires them to do that. And this gets at something else that's interesting. Framers wrote the Constitution. They presupposed that political parties wouldn't exist. And George Washington, because they viewed political parties as dangerous. And what we saw was a situation where George Washington, when he leaves office in 1796, worries about political parties, how dangerous they are. And that's what's happened. Our Congress is captured by political parties and partisan interests in many ways, preventing them from getting their job done.
Well, it sure makes it impossible for them to work for most Americans, that's for sure.
Correct.
Okay, let's talk about the way that Congress is not working right now. Even with special counsel for the Russian meddling in our 2016 election. And it seems to me that this should be illegal. I can't understand for the life of me. If it took forever for them to say finally, okay, yeah, it's collusion. And then they say, oh, collusion is not illegal. And then I keep asking my guests, so are we at treason yet? Where are we at?
Well, at this point, if one were to look at A lot of the reports that are out there, a lot of the evidence, congressional hearings and so forth, look at what the Mueller investigation has come up with. It's pretty clear first. I don't think one can dispute the fact that, A, the Russians did try to interfere with the U.S. elections in 2016. That's incontrovertible. No matter what anybody says from any place, that evidence is pretty powerful at this point. But now the question becomes, did Trump himself or his associates in some way, shape, or form collude or work with the Russians? Now, collusion itself is not a legal term. Aiding and abetting, conspiracy are legal terms. And that's exactly where we are right now is that we are in a situation where the Mueller investigation is, I think, getting close to completing an answer to what I think is a legal question. A legal question which is, do they believe that there's enough evidence to suggest that, again, Trump and his associates in some way violated the law? I would call that legal truth. That's what we're going to find out at this point. I would say at this point we've got factual evidence of Russian interference. We have some, but we certainly don't know all the evidence that the Trump administration, or that the Mueller investigation has produced. But that's where we are at this point. And I think that's the fascinating question, because in some ways what we're confusing is, let us say, legal truth versus what might be political truth versus what might be real truth. And that's what's really being confused right now. And I'm not sure how good the court of public opinion is in terms of sorting those three different notions of truth out.
Yeah, well, we need public opinion to really be involved in this. We need to scream as loud as we can, because at this point, if we keep allowing this to go on from month to month to month, we're going to be in far worse shape, and we might have a king on our hands. I really have to put that out there. I know a lot of people disagree with me and say that, no, the Constitution will stand, withstand all of this mess that is going on right now, but we really have to pay attention, because it's not just our country. This is a concerted effort by groups across the world, taking down institutions that are democratic, that are saying, you know, let the people have their say, let the people have the word. It's all about the people, we the people. And that is starting to change across the first world countries. So this is very concerning to me. Sir, can you stay with us? Because next I want to ask you about, where do we go from here? Is that okay?
Perfect.
All right. We'll be right back in just a moment. It is now 8:25 here at WCCO. Welcome back. You are listening to Steele Talk, and I'm your host, Geraldine Steele. For 20 years, I have loved sitting behind this mic with you, and thank you for the opportunity. Joining me for this half hour has been Professor David Schultz, political science professor at Hamline University. And we are really talking about how the Congress is, you know, very quiet right now. We're not quite sure what their communication even is, but they are communicating. They're just not communicating with the most of us. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you.
So where do we go from here?
Well, where do we go from here? I mean, part of the problem you're getting at here, and this is interesting, is that there's been several really good, I'm going to call them political science studies, that have pointed out that Congress no longer represents the will of the majority, but instead they represent the will of what? About the top 1% of our income in the United States, those people who are very rich. We know that there's only about, let's say, 200 donors in the United States that constitute the vast majority of the political contributions that go to candidates. And we know that there is a bias in terms of who spends money to lobby and influence Congress. The point that I'm getting at is that Congress really well represents the rich. And to me, the starting point is that we need to figure out a way of breaking that connection between money and politics, because that is really what is distorting our political process. And we sometimes think that the American public doesn't agree on anything. But one thing that we do know, and remember when Donald Trump ran as candidate and he talked about draining the swamp,
yes.
We have evidence that suggests across the political spectrum, about 85% of the American public says we need to do something to get money out of politics. That, to me, is the first step.
We've been talking about it a long time, right up there with taxes and education and so much more, and nothing seems to be done about it. Do you think there's a possibility?
Unfortunately, not in the near future, but I don't think we can solve any of the other problems, taxes, education, until we solve the money and politics issue. Many, many years ago, some listeners might know, I used to be the chair and the executive director for Common Cause Minnesota, which works on sort of money and politics ethics issues. And I had the pleasure at one point of having Archibald Cox come to Minnesota. He was the special prosecutor during Watergate. And Archibald Cox, person far brighter than I am, turned to me once and said, "The rules about money in politics is the rule that determines the rules of the game." And what he meant by that is who gets to spend money, who gets to leverage influence determines how the rest of the game of politics is played. And until we figure out a way of changing that rule, we can't change anything else.
Well, I'm not quite sure if all of the amendments that we've made has really made us better. That's for sure. My final question for you, sir. Time is at the forefront of this investigation. Of course, as we look at the Nixon administration and the Democrats were in power in the Congress at that time, it still took almost 4 years for him to resign.
Yeah.
You know, it took a lot of time. And I worry that we are running out of time because things have such severe cuts and challenges are happening right now that I feel we are running out of time where we can even correct it.
Yes, I think. Well, first off, two ways of answering your question. I think the Mueller investigation, in terms of the fact finding, comes to an end in the next couple of months, and then the legal proceedings will kick in. But I think the November elections are tremendously important in terms of the next step of where we take American democracy, and who shows up will have a big bearing on really sort of the future of American democracy and on so many of the questions that you've been raising tonight.
Well, I sure appreciate you joining us. What a pleasure to have you back on Steel Talk, and I hope we can do it again.
I hope so, too. Talk to you soon.
All right, David. Take care.
Bye.
That is Professor Schultz from Hamline University. And, of course, he always brings such wisdom. And there's something very calming about his voice that just calms us down, doesn't it? So I really appreciate him joining us. It is now 8:29. We're going to take a break, pay some bills, and come back with the weather. It is now 8:34 here at WCCO. Welcome back. You're listening to Steel Talking. I'm your host, Geraldine Steele, and this half hour, we got a lot to talk about. You heard of the storm called Omarosa, right? I think that's where they are with the alphabet right now for a hurricane. Because this child has hit the stage and refuses to relinquish it. And Trump is claiming that Omarosa is violating her non-disclaimer agreement. We've been hearing a lot about non-disclaimer, right? Well, Karen is going to explain what non-disclosure agreement is and if Trump has a case. And when I say Karen, I'm speaking of Karen Nelson Schaefer, attorney with Balian, Thome, Joswiak, and Wanta. Welcome to WCCO, Karen.
Thank you, Darlene.
Okay. I bet your phone is ringing off the hook because everyone wants to know. So what's the deal with this non-disclosure agreement? What is it? Tell us first, what is it?
Sure. So a non-disclosure agreement is essentially a contract between, you know, two parties or could be more. It's a legally enforceable contract where one or more parties agree not to disclose information that they've shared with each other. And you know, they have a lot of really important purposes. They can be used when two companies are in negotiations about whether or not one will buy the other. And during the process, you know, they have to share confidential information that they don't otherwise want disclosed. You know, there's cases where, let's say, an entrepreneur doesn't, you know, she needs to hire an employee. She doesn't want that employee stealing ideas. And so she has the employee sign a non-disclosure agreement to prevent that employee from sharing the information that he or she learned in the scope of her employment.
Okay.
And then if you have a non-disclosure agreement and somebody shares the information that they've agreed not to share, then there's damages as a result. It's a breach of contract, and the party who's been harmed can sue the other party for breach of contract.
And can that remain instated even if, you know, posthumously? And the reason I ask, I know I've had to sign non-disclosure agreements before. My son performed for Michael Jackson's son's birthday party, and he had to sign a non-disclosure agreement. And to this day, he's not comfortable talking about any of it.
Yeah, I mean, so you're saying talking about Michael Jackson.
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, non-disclosure agreements have different timelines depending on the non-disclosure agreement. I mean, certainly if your son has agreed not to talk about something with respect to Michael Jackson, it would make, I mean, he's certainly better off keeping it quiet because Michael Jackson's estate may have an issue if he discloses the information.
Oh, okay. So it really is throughout the world in perpetuity.
It can be. I mean, so the length of a non-disclosure agreement is a pretty complicated issue, but it certainly can go on past someone's death.
Okay. Does this matter? Because for me, it sounds that this is the norm in entertainment business, and as well as high tech companies and that sort of thing. But what about public companies? The big argument I've been hearing about Omarosa supposedly signing this NDA is that she's a public servant when she was in the White House, and so it really doesn't count. Is that true?
Well, public companies are different than the fact that she's serving in the White House. So yes, it is true that a public servant is going to be treated differently than a private citizen just contracting with a company. So, you know, this is sort of the $10 million question in this case is whether or not it's enforceable against a public servant like her. And so typically non-disparagement or clauses or non-disclosure agreements are going to be upheld by the court unless they contribute to crime or endanger the public, the health, safety, or matters of public concern. But when it comes to public employees, I mean, so Omarosa and other people working in the White House are public servants. They're not, Donald Trump's employees. They're not employees of Trump companies.
Right.
And so there's a couple of things that weigh in favor of unenforcement that wouldn't be true for private employees. So one of them is the First Amendment. The First Amendment protects government workers from speaking about matters of public concern. And that makes sense. I mean, you know, the idea is that we want the government to be transparent. We want to know what's going on inside of the government. And so the First Amendment prevents the government from constricting speech of government workers. Now, obviously, there's limitations with things like national security. But when it comes, you know, we're talking about the reputation of the president, his mental state of mind, things mm-hmm. like that. The First Amendment is probably going to protect her. Another piece is public policy. So contracts can be found to be void because they violate public policy. And in this case, the public has an interest in knowing what's going on inside the White House, what's going on with President Trump's mental health. And so those are reasons that it would likely be void. And it sounds like, you know, the attorney who drafted these himself may have believed that they weren't going to be enforceable for these very reasons.
And why do you say that?
Well, so.
I believe we've lost her. Are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes. I'm so sorry. All of a sudden you went away. So go right ahead.
I'm sorry. So the attorney who drafted these, I mean, and this is all rumor, of course, but apparently did not believe that they were going to be enforceable and encouraged, you know, Donald Trump not to enforce these, not to have the people inside the White House sign them, but ultimately gave in to doing so because it was important to President Trump. But my understanding is that he himself did not think that they were going to be enforceable, that they were just being done because it was important to President Trump that they were done.
Okay, so she started working with him during the campaign. And of course,
right.
he's not a public servant yet, and neither
right.
is she. So if she signed it then, is it still enforced after he becomes a public servant and after she becomes a public servant?
Right. So it depends. Of course, it always seems to depend. So there's three different non-disclosure agreements that President Trump has been that he's having people sign. And my understanding is one is the 2016, you know, campaign. One is in the White House, and then one is for the 2020 reelection campaign. And so when before President Trump was the president and before the people working for him were public servants, he certainly is free to have them sign non-disclosure agreements about confidential information. So if Omarosa learned something about, you know, Ivanka Trump's company or one of Trump's companies while working for him, there's an argument, depending on the specific language of the non-disclosure agreement, that she's going to be bound by the non-disclosure agreement. But once he becomes a public official and she becomes a public servant, then the non-disclosure, well, then we expect that the non-disclosure agreement is going to be found void for, you know, the First Amendment and public policy and the things I previously mentioned.
Okay, so what happens really at the conventions? Because a lot of different things change when you become the nominee, okay? When you become
right.
the nominee of the DNC and you become the nominee of the GOP. All of a sudden, you have to disclose certain things. You're the one that will possibly be the president of the United States. Wouldn't it, at that point, there has to be some gray area there for the NDAs, because now you really could be working a campaign for a candidate who is protected by the Secret Service, who right. has, you know, a lot of information about what's going on now. He's had to disclose this and that. So wouldn't that NDA go out even at the time you become the candidate?
So, I mean, to some extent, the truth is, I mean, these situations rarely come up. So we really don't know exactly what's going to happen in this case, right? But yes, I mean, when President Trump is running for president and learning a lot of information, obviously in that case, the non-disclosure agreements actually become more important, right? Because there's issues of national security that can't be disclosed. But, you know, the exact moment that Omarosa would no longer be bound by the non-disclosure agreement, it's really unclear. And I think that that's something that we will learn going forward.
And of course, she has already met with Special Counsel Mueller and given a lot of information, it sounds like. And so even if President Trump were to come forward and say, well, I'm going to sue her because she went against this agreement, would he even have any standing considering now the special counsel investigation? She's a part of that.
Well, I mean, it really depends on what he's going to sue her for, right? I mean, if he is going to try to sue her for disclosing things about observations while in the White House, I mean, I think he's going to have a hard time no matter what. Because right now it's in an arbitration, we don't really know what it is that he's alleging and which pieces of information he's accusing her of using in violation of the non-disclosure agreement. And so to some extent, we really have to wait and see until it plays out a little bit to figure out whether or not he is standing, to figure out what she said to special counsel, and then what he's accusing her of, how he's accusing her of violating the NDA.
Well, she sure seems to be very confident compared to how the president is reacting.
She sure does.
You know, it's amazing to me. And a lot of these NDA cases are brought to trial, right? But not necessarily when it comes to politics.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, in the private sector, so, you know, no, a lot of them are not brought to trial. Very few civil cases go to trial anymore. I mean, it's 98% of these cases settle outside of trial. Mm-hmm. So they may go to litigation. But the ones that we see actually going to trial are the huge cases where, you know, two massive companies are suing each other for trade secret violations. And there's just so much money at stake that there's no way to reach common ground. But generally, these cases are not going to trial.
Okay, and those cases can go on for a long time, right?
Oh, they can. I mean, I would say the shortest life of a case is, you know, 2.5-3 years, but they can go on for 6, 7, 8 years. And the more complicated they are, the more trade secrets at issue, the more confidential information at issue, the longer they'll go on.
Wow. Incredible to me. If I wanted to get out of an NDA, what should be my first step? Especially in the entertainment industry, what should I do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, honestly, the first thing you should do is talk to a lawyer and have them read your non-disclosure agreement and tell you really what it is, how it's limiting you, whether or not you're bound by it. And then oftentimes an attorney can help you negotiate a way out of it if that's what you want to do. But it's always best to at least consult with an attorney first so that you understand your rights and your risks.
Wow, I tell you, it's you know, the NDA is now so much a part of our lexicon that I suspect it'll be as important as a prenup, as people get together in relationships,
yeah.
whether it's the company's merging or whether it's a union of two people. It's just going to be at the forefront now for a very long time, I am afraid.
We are certainly seeing a lot more of it in the employment setting.
Wow. Incredible. Last question for you. Omarosa's NDA seems really important to both sides, to the Trump administration that is left in the White House, as well as Mueller's team. How will they decide who and when? Like in her book, she's already disclosed a lot that has gone on, but now she has tapes. And of course, she's met with Mueller to let them hear these tapes. But if she has more, And Donald Trump is in the midst of suing her, would she have to stop, cease and desist until they come to some understanding?
Well, that depends. I mean, certainly Donald Trump would like for her to stop. From my understanding, she's not going to stop. But at some point, it could be if a judge or an arbitrator require mandates that she stop until this issue is resolved. She could be court ordered to stop. But as of yet, we haven't heard that that's happened.
Wow. Court ordered to stop. You know, I was in a pageant once, I have to tell you, Karen, and there was a what do you call that, where they stopped the pageant from going forward because of something that was illegal that was done. I forget what you call it. An injunction. That's what it was.
Oh, yeah.
So they had an injunction happen, and all of a sudden we had to cease and desist. In fact, we were delayed. It was supposed to be for like a whole weekend of this pageant, but it ended up being only a day because there was so much going on with this injunction. Is that sort of what can happen to the NDA, that there can be an injunction that stops her from doing any business with Mueller even?
I don't think an arbitrator would have the authority to prevent her from talking to Mueller, because I just don't think that an arbitrator would have the authority to do that. But absolutely, what you're describing happened in your pageant is what happens when there's an injunction while a case is pending. So if you pull it out of this situation and just, you know, if two companies are suing each other for disclosing information and the court is trying to interpret the NDA and interpret what confidential information can and cannot be disclosed, the court might say, you know, while I'm figuring this out, I don't want anyone disclosing this information anymore.
Wow.
And then once the court has an order, you know, depending on what that order is, the parties can continue to disclose information.
And of course, we're talking about the White House, but this is also true for Congress and for all of the staffers that work for them.
When you say it's also true,
that the non-disclosure agreement has to be signed and it can be upheld for staffers that work for Congress, although they are public servants, or you're saying that it's the same whether you are a public servant in the White House or in Congress, period. In the Constitution, it states that they ought to be able to speak on these things when needed.
That's right. So if you're a public servant, and not just in the White House, but if you're a public servant, the Constitution prohibits the government from preventing you from speaking. So it could be that all of these staffers have non-disclosure agreements, but they're going to have to be very limited if they're going to be enforceable. Now, they may have them with respect to issues of national security, but that's a different issue because, of course, they're prevented from sharing issues, you know, from sharing information they learn in the scope of their employment connected to national security.
And then we must define national security at that point. That's right. An ever-changing thing.
Right. Yes, it is.
Karen, I really appreciate you joining us tonight and presenting clarity for us with this whole non-disclosure agreement. And I can just imagine the people listening tonight thinking, I will never do that.
Right.
Thanks so much for joining us. We sure appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. That was Karen Nelson Schaefer, attorney with Balian, Thome, Joswiak, and Wanta. Are we going to take a break and then come back and finish up this half hour? If you'd like to join the conversation or you have a comment about this whole non-disclosure agreement, did you ever have a chance to, or were you ever made to sign one? Were you uncomfortable with it when you did it? You know, I had a client ask me one time when we were really disagreeing over the contract. And he said, you mean you read the contract? A whole lot of people, especially entertainers, don't read the contract. And I thought, what do you mean? Of course we're going to read the contract word for word, line for line. But I was very surprised to hear him confidently state that, oh, please, performers, artists, they don't sign. They don't read contracts. They just sign them. Well, I wonder, have you ever had that situation, whether you were in a private company or a public where you signed a non-disclosure agreement and didn't quite understand what you were doing? Give us a call at 651-989-9226. It is now 8:54 here at WCCO. Welcome back. My name is Geraldine Steele. This is Steele Talking. And of course, we've been talking about some pretty serious things, but we've learned, or at least I hope that you have gleaned as much as I have from some of the conversations tonight. What's interesting is that when we ended the conversation with Karen, Jonathan Lowe, our in-studio producer tonight, he and I started talking about, wow, how far can this go? And Jonathan, I asked you, well, what about the state houses across the country? And you were saying, well, if it's, you know, for the United States, you know, if they're part of the legislation in D.C., then, yeah, we know if you're a public servant, absolutely, the NDA will probably go away.
Well, that is my assumption, is that if you sign a non-disclosure agreement in a federal jurisdiction, with a federal portion of the government, I would think that it would continue within the borders of the country.
Right.
Now, if you did that, now you were bringing up the possibility of this going on at a state level.
Exactly, because we have our own constitution.
Right. So if you sign a non-disclosure in one state, would that follow you from state to state? The thing I was looking at is if you sign something in a federal sense,
right,
would that follow you from country to country?
And I would think it would, particularly if we have the embassies. If it's someone that's working in an embassy, that's still part of us, right?
But let's say you're not staying in an embassy. Let's say you have a home.
Let's say you're military.
I would say military would fall into the same thing as embassy because it is an American property. It is a United States property.
Yeah, but not all of our military leaders are staying at the embassy. So,
right. But what I'm saying is if you're outside of an embassy or you're outside of a military base, mm-hmm. if you're out in the country, let's say you're out in the countryside of France.
Like an expat. Or, yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Does that follow you to another country?
All right. Yeah.
That's my question.
Once you're a federal worker, I wonder if it just remains that way forever and ever. Amen. Boy, interesting.
I might ask my mom, but I don't think she signed any non-disclosure agreements. I don't know if she did.
Yeah, she worked for the state or she worked for the
federal? She worked for the federal government, for HUD.
Wow, I had an uncle that worked for the CIA, and he was so stealth-like and wouldn't talk anything. In fact, the cousins would say, you know, uncle, what did you do for 30 years for the CIA? And he would go to another subject. So whatever he did, it was serious business to him, that's for sure. But we don't know. We don't know, man.
The CIA don't
he
play.
He died with that NDA, for yeah. real.
Like I said, that should be the new slogan of the CIA. The CIA don't play.
Don't mess with me. Don't mess with me. There you go. That's what it is. What a pleasure it's been to learn more. I love that. We need clarity, right? In order to deal and move forward, we absolutely need clarity. So stay tuned because we have so many other questions that have been unanswered, but I expect that we will have clarity on it all sooner than later, I hope. So stay strong. Keep your head up. Coming up next is all things arts and entertainment. We call it Center Stage. Oh, we're going to have a good time.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.